If needlework is your passion, whether you're stitching by hand, machine, or mixing it all up, you're going to want to hear about the Mr. X Stitch Contemporary Needlework Prize 2025. This prize celebrates the best in modern stitch and it's open to creatives from all around the world, whether you're a student or an emerging artist or a seasoned professional. And the best part, you don't have to send your work anywhere. Just upload high-resolution images to a private folder we will send you after you enter. You can enter more than one category, for instance, hand embroidery and 3D textiles. Just grab an entry for each one. And if you've got a student ID, you can get 50% off the entry price as well. The deadline for entering is 30th of June 2025, and entries are now open at xstitchmag.com/prize-entry. Thanks to our brilliant sponsors, Bookmarked Hub by Search Press and David and Charles, and the legends at Lowry Workstands. If you've got the stitch bug, this is your time. Show us what you've got. Enter the prize now. Visit xstitchmag.com/prize-entry to get your ticket today. Welcome back to Needle Exchange, the podcast where we unravel the stories behind embroidery and textile art. My name's Jamie Chalmers, aka Mr. X Stitch, and this is the second part of my conversation with the thought-provoking textile artist, Bren Ahern. In this half, we shift gears into the deeper themes within Bren's work, how traditional samplers became subversive, the role of craftivism, and the evolving perception of embroidery as a gendered art form. Bren also shares insights into his large-scale projects, including his exploration of school shootings through pennant banners and his approach to breaking down binaries in art and identity. If you enjoyed my conversation with Kate Kretz, that's episodes 41 and 42, where we explored ways in which needlework makes a political point, this will be right up your alley. Be sure to subscribe to Needle Exchange on your favourite podcasting platform. If you have time to leave a review, I would be over the moon with that. And always check out Mr. X Stitch on Instagram if you want to keep up with more needlework inspiration. I will be back next week with another part of the needlework infrastructure ecosystem, the world of stitch. Call it what you will. I'll be back next week. I love you guys. Thank you for listening. Enjoy the show. In a way, the thing that always interested me, and it wasn't really a conversation I was planning on having, but with your pieces, I was just interested to kind of understand what it was like to be a gay man in the time that you grew up, because I'm not a gay man, so I don't know. And I hope that it's been a kind experience, but I can't really tell because you've been stitching these magnified moments, and I guess they're quite evocative.
Yeah, the interesting thing, before I start talking about my own experience, is that I think that all of us have periods in which we feel alienated. We feel isolated. Of course, I'm just generalizing. I don't know about your experience. We feel like we just don't quite fit in. So get to your question, growing up as a gay man in the 70s, I kind of felt like I didn't fit in because there was this this rigid masculinity. That being said, you talk about your experience with the Formula One versus the Mercedes. I had another friend who talked about his experience with sports. I think his brother was really good with sports, but he didn't feel like doing sports, and he's not gay. And sports, that's a whole nother story. So sports, Pat Griffin, she's this professor at, I think, University of Massachusetts in Amherst, talks about sports are where boys are taught to take their place in American society. They're taught to be homophobic, to be sexist. For example, you throw like a girl, or you don't play football, what are you, a fag or something like that? So kind of a mixed relationship with sports. But that being said, I feel as though I wasn't really, in terms of throwing a ball or something like that, I never really was taught how to throw a ball in my youth. And I realized then that you go to gym class and then they're saying, oh, play baseball, but you're not really. So physical education in the U.S. is you're not really taught how to do something. You're just expected to perform.
Yeah.
And so I had this awareness about last year. Someone posted actually on Instagram. Instagram is useful for many things. I was like, oh, yeah, I was never really taught how to throw a ball. And so it was a really eye-opening moment for me. So part of my feelings of isolation from my youth might have been from being gay. Part of it may have been just from not being taught how to act in certain situations, and having to, and that's a tough one because I wouldn't really say it's up to my parents to teach me how to perform my gender. It's because there were times when I was kind of femme, kind of girly, and I quickly learned, you're not supposed to be that way. Mm. So that being said, I don't know if I'd say it's my parents' responsibility to teach me that.
Such a movable feast, isn't it? There was a similar analogy in some ways, because after my parents got divorced, I ate a lot. And I've still got a healthy secret eating habit to this day. Congratulations, listeners. There's a bit of overshare.
You have a what?
A healthy secret eating habit.
Oh, secret. Okay.
It's a good one. So I gained a lot of weight. And so by about the age of 10 or whatever, I was quite a fat kid. And then when you go and do sports, because you're fat, they think you're good at, like, you're strong or something. So we would get taught to do the shot put, except we wouldn't get taught to do anything, as to your point. We just get given a shot put and you'd be like, oh, I'll throw it. But I'm fat, I'm not strong, so I throw it about a half a foot or something, you know. And it's the same with tennis. Like, we would just rock up and nobody would teach us tennis, but there'd be the one kid who maybe had learned a little bit who is better and would get all the attention, and off they go, Malcolm Gladwell's Outliers and all that sort of stuff, you know. So I think there's something there. Like, one of the things, as I approached parenthood, I was stressed about the thought of having boys, and we didn't know what we were having until they popped out, because I wasn't certain how my version of masculinity would fit in. I wasn't sure how, I don't think I could be a football dad, because I'm not a sporty person. We're in a safe space. I'm not a sporty person particularly, but so many of those things that you think dads should do just felt like cliches, felt like marketing, felt like the stuff we've been talking about before. And it does make me wonder what it actually means to be a modern man and to be true to yourself. I'm very glad to be a girl dad. I'm very glad that these days I can openly admit that there are episodes of the cartoon show Bluey that make me cry, and I'm at peace with that. You know, there's all these things, and I'm just trying to feel it out. And I think that, I don't know. I don't know what the answer is, but to be a modern man is a thing that is very elusive. And to be a modern man that's the truth of you, as opposed to what the marketing says, regardless of whether it's being in touch with the emotions or being a blowhard, you know, let's go, guys, sort of thing. It's almost, I don't know, maybe it's almost impossible. I don't know what it is to be a man. I know what it is to be Jamie Chalmers on a good day.
And you point to that idea of different ideas of masculinity or different masculinities. My masculinity might be different than your masculinity, which is different than someone else's masculinity. And so what makes me sad is, in the U.S., I think they're kind of trying to force people into one particular notion of masculinity, which may not fit everyone.
Mm. And it feels like maybe it's easier for there to be different notions of femininity. Maybe there's more ground there. You and I now are drifting into territory we are not able to talk about. But you know what I mean? Because you don't know. But I feel like there's a greater breadth of variety in the female ideal. And when I'm not talking physically, I'm just talking about like spiritually or whatever. Whereas to be a man, you know, I think there's something about being strong as a man, but that doesn't mean being aggressive as a man. You know, I'm quite proud to be able to pick up my children and make them feel safe and secure around me. But at the same time, I'm quite happy to sit down and like, don't know, cry with them or whatever, you know. And I don't know where I'm going with that, to be honest.
But if you notice that, do you feel as though because you have maybe a softer masculinity that people are more drawn to you?
I think what I'm not afraid to disarm people. Like I did an interview. I did an interview with Sally Maver, I think it was. And she said, I've got a knack for disarming people. And I think that's part of that is that. And it's the same with the whole Mr. X thing, to be honest. It's just like, I'm 6 foot tall. I've got tattoos. I've got a face only a mother could love. I do cross-stitch, you know, the juxtapose is there, the contrast, but I always use that as a tool to get people to pay attention to needlework then. If I could go, well, I'm not what you expect, perhaps needlework isn't what you expect. And I think perhaps that's part of the sort of the masculine thing as well. Like, I don't know if people are drawn to me, but I know that I'm not afraid to talk about, I don't know, watching Bake Off or talk about just sensitive topics. I'm not afraid to talk about them. And maybe that makes me slightly more magnetic than some people who just peddled out the same cliches. I don't know.
Yeah, because I've always found you to be intriguing with your you've been a contradiction in American terms.
Right.
You know, this big guy who is super nice, who is bald, who has a beard. All these things are like in conflict in American society, or stereotypical American society.
It's true. I mean, I really should be gay. If you wrote it down on paper, and I remember once someone freaked me and they said that I was gay, and about 20 people were like, I knew it all the time. And I was like, I'm sorry, guys. I'm sorry. I'm just like, it's a tricky one, isn't it? It's hard to negotiate. But I think just the ideas of identity, I don't know, man.
But it's also, but that kind of makes me sad. It makes me laugh, but also makes me sad what you said about, oh, you should be gay. Because on the opposite side were gay guys who are into sports. People get confused, like, what? You do sports?
Yeah, and that's what I mean. And there's that whole layer, isn't there? Like professional football players and all those kind of people who just can't be open and honest about it as though they're the taboos. And it comes back again, doesn't it? It just comes back to that whole embroidery is needlework. You told the tales you told, you know, all of these things, they all kind of loop back. I never really realized that just by getting involved in a bit of cross stitch, it would end up being something that's so like grounded in all these stories. Like, it's really hard to unpick it. I was talking with an artist called Caro, and we were talking about the way feminine roles changed because of industrialization, capitalization. Bear with me on this one, right? So it used to be in an agrarian society, everybody worked near or around the homestead. Women were at home, men would go out and do hunter-gathering and come back, but women ran the show. They ran the show in their homes. Capitalism comes along and suddenly there's this thing where, because men have maybe got more physical prowess, they're able to produce more and produce more for other people. So that has a value. And then when capitalism takes a hold and starts creating things like factories where you have to go and work, women who are staying at home can't go and work. So they get slightly disenfranchised by the system. And that begins this thing that then goes, oh, well, men have made all the money in our factories while women are staying. Do you know what I mean? And all of that kind of comes from there. And I was just like, oh, God, yeah. Yeah, you're probably right about that as well.
And tied in with that, interestingly enough, is in the factories, for example, the weaving factories, I believe it was the men who ran the show, but the women who ran the actual looms, if I recall correctly. So,
yeah. And it's just, I don't know, it's just an interesting one, because then you've got this thing about, you know, women needing to stay at home for biological reasons, a child rearing and all of those kind of things. And that, rather than being an asset, which it may have been in the 1400s, becomes this like liability, because they can't be at the factory producing enough for their lords and masters and all that kind of thing. And it's just, and that shift there, we're now again 400 years down the line off of the back of that. And here we are talking about it now, you know?
Yeah, but it's interesting you used the term lords and masters. Was that for the contemporary context? when you said the women are having babies and they can't be in the factory producing for their lords and masters, was that... this is just a side comment. Was that a comment about the rulers of the factories today? And if it was, that's okay.
I mean, not specifically. What I'm trying to do at the moment is not sort of, you know, I'm just looking at the historical context there, because I think that was quite bold. But what's going on now in the world, honestly, like, what I'm in some ways trying to do is go, do you know what? I'm not going to try and talk about it too much, because it's a bit time bound. And I like to think in like 6 years time, maybe it'll be different or something. But we might have all gone into hell in a handcuff by that point. It's hard to say. But I just, you know, because sometimes I just think, you know, we're all beings. We're just here and we're just supposed to be like living our lives and supposed to be like making the world a better place. And somewhere down the line, we've lost sight of that. We've just lost the sight of it. We know intrinsically what it feels like to sit and do some making and how internally that makes us feel connected to some bigger picture, some bigger purpose. And we're so lost sight of all that.
Yeah, I like what you said, because I view my role as kind of, what am I doing to make the world a better place, to inspire others, rather than to bring others down.
So. Yeah. And I mean, what are you doing? What do you think you're doing?
What do I do? Talking to people, acknowledging people. For example, in our building, we have workers who work at the front desk, and there are people who walk by them and don't say hi at all to them. And I'm not saying I'm better because I say hi, but I've been in positions like that, low-level positions, where people have thought I was stupid, that I didn't deserve to be spoken to. And so that's from my own experience, but also just the idea that someone's there, you acknowledge them. And so it's little gestures like that.
Mm. Yeah, I think that's it. It's just small kindnesses. I quite liked, so I grew up in the south of England, if you like, about an hour north from London. And now I live in what is technically the north of England. I mean, it's only like, is it a 3-hour drive from where I grew up or whatever. But up here, when you walk past someone in the street, you do say hello to them. Down south, if I said hello to someone in the street, they'd probably scream and run out into the traffic or something. It's such an alien concept. But I think it is. It's just those little differences. And even sometimes I just think, you know, maybe that's all we're meant to do, really. Kind of tread lightly, be nice to the people around us. And then at least we can look back and go, well, that was a good life. You know, I might not have made £10 billion, but I didn't really need £10 billion or something.
Yeah. And it goes back also, this idea of just being kind to people, talking to people, being empathetic, hearing them where they are.
Mm.
Which goes back to what we're talking about with Kratavism, of not alienating half the population in the country.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, it's interesting that point, because I think, you know, you can make political messages, you can be an angry Kratavist and that kind of thing, and that's fine. And what it might do is it might resonate with some people. And if that's a means to an end and it gets those people thinking about something, then that's fine. But I think, like, I joke about it, but, you know, I discovered that I had fertility issues. And when that came up, I decided to stitch the 5 stages of grief. And I stitched the word anger. No, I stitched the word denial. And then I stitched the word anger. And then I felt a bit better. And it's the same with, like, stitching really angry things. Like, I just don't think it can be sustainable, because it shouldn't be sustainable. Because I don't think we should live in an angry space, or, you know, a sweary space for our whole lives. It just, I don't know, that's a life less well lived or something.
Yeah. So what would you say to someone who is always angry?
Maybe probably need to talk to somebody, go and stare at a tree, go hug a tree. Maybe that would do it. I don't know. It's difficult, isn't it? There's a million and one reasons why people are right. I just think, you know, I thought it'd be quite funny one day to do like 100 fucks in cross stitch or something like that, and just almost like play around with that thing. But after a while, I was like, do you know what? I'd get so bored of that. I get so bored of it. And it's even the sweary stuff that I used to do back in the day, I just think that's part of the process. And I would just hope that anybody, you know, unless you're a stand-up comedian and being really dark is your shtick. But even like one of my favorite comedians is this guy called Anthony Jeselnik, and he's brilliant. And I've seen him live, but his stuff is so very dark. But he's deliberately doing dark comedy. He's doing it with skill. It's really, he kind of like sends you down one way and takes you on a very different direction. But outside of his doing his work, making his art aware, he's just a really nice guy who wants to make the world a better place. You know what I mean? It's like,
yeah.
I don't think we can.
That's interesting you mentioned about the dark comedy, because that reminds me of when I had a couple of my death samplers in a show, and one of the reviewers said, oh, you can tell Brand grew up in the time of AIDS because all of his work is about death. And I thought, I never realized that. So it's interesting just how, this is a little aside, just how sometimes these messages from outside can say, oh, can bring new awarenesses to you.
Yeah, and it was interesting talking with John Thomas Paradiso about all that kind of stuff as well, because his works are maybe a little bit more explicitly leaning into gay culture. But, you know, he was involved a lot around the time of the AIDS. Pandemic isn't the right word. I don't feel like the right word now.
But epidemic.
Epidemic, thank you. You know, that whole situation was something that he was really intimately connected with, and I think a lot of his work kind of tied into that as well, and notions of, like, gay culture that was kind of hidden and dark, and at the same time a lot of the death and the pain that was brought as a consequence of that. I mean, I don't know, and I'm naive to this, but maybe if you're a gay man of a certain age, the AIDS epidemic has got to have had a bearing on your life, because it was such a profound thing.
Yeah, it's interesting. When I was in school with this visiting professor, and it was a 3D structures class, and for our first project we had to do a memorial to something. And so I did this, I was like, well, what should I memorialize? And so I decided to memorialize coming of age during the time of AIDS. And so I did this, it was a total Keith Haring 80s knockoff piece. And I had things like Nancy Reagan saying, just say no, images of her. I had Ronald Reagan, condoms, all sorts of images, Keith Haring, stuff like that. And when I presented to the class, I started crying, and I just said what it was like. This is kind of represents my coming of age during the time of AIDS. So after the critique, the teacher and I were alone, she said, I wanted to talk to you as your big sister. And to me, that's immediate. It's an immediate red flag when someone says something like that. So she said, oh, you don't want to be known as a gay artist. You just want to be known as an artist.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, this is good. This makes her uncomfortable. I need to do more of this. And so for the next project in the class, I got an army tent and I lined it with pink lamé and I applique on images of gay icons. And so so I'm actually grateful for her because I was kind of floundering in terms of content and direction. So, so even feedback like that, I think, can point us in a positive direction.
Yeah, and sometimes, yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Yeah, it just sends you in the right way. I mean, are there other queer artists that you particularly admire? Are there people who you think like really hit the thing on the nose?
Yeah, many, many. It's hard to put on the spot because I know I'm going to forget to list some. I love the work of Nathan Vincent.
Mm-hmm.
Are you familiar with him?
I've definitely heard of him. Yeah, I'm sure if I had a look. Because I've got the, I wrote a thing in the Queer Threads book. I'm pretty sure he's in that, isn't he?
Yeah, yeah. He wrote, he did this crocheted locker room. So he crocheted a big installation of a locker room, which is kind of a, I guess, a stereotypically queer space with homoerotic space with cruising and the like. Like his work, of course, now I'm still on the spot. I can't think of any.
Do you think needlework lends itself well? I mean, you chose it as a medium, I guess, to document your own pinpoints, your own experiences. Do you think it's a useful tool for people who are queer and to explore that kind of identity?
Well, yeah, well, the idea of queer, it's interesting because I feel as though because queer, with queer theory, that's what I'm trying to say. But anyway, to answer your question about thread, I think it's a perfect thing for queer people because you have fine art. I mean, you have photography and painting and sculpture as fine art. And then thread kind of comes in as this like queer little thing. Well, what's this? So it's, I think it's kind of breaking down the power structures. And so I like it from that way. Have you ever read the article by L.J. Roberts? I forget what it's called, but it's this whole thing about applying queer theory to crafts.
I have not. No.
If I find a copy, I'll send it to you.
Yeah, do.
But what am I trying to say? So L.J. Roberts, are you familiar with L.J.'s work?
No.
L.J. Roberts deals a lot with queer. So L.J. Roberts is another queer artist whose work I love. One project, while L.J. was in school, there was a school called the California College of Arts and Crafts. And then this is in the early, I think, 2000s or so. They changed the school because craft, I guess, was a dirty word.
Mm.
They changed it to California College of Crafts. So basically, it went from California College of Arts and Crafts to California College of the Arts. That's what it is. And so for a while at the school on their building, they took down the word crafts.
Mm.
And so LJ, for a while, it just read as California College of Arts, I think. They didn't put the in yet.
Mm-hmm.
So LJ actually got some Lucite letters and covered them with, I think, crochet, and then did a guerrilla installation and put up the word and crafts up where it used to be. So it was in crochet. So that's a perfect, I think, example of queering, using a queer person using this queer medium to, I guess, subvert.
It's one of the challenges I face is being a cis white male. It makes it quite difficult. I love the fact that needlework is such a great tool for people to explore all these different identities, but I'm very well aware of my own shortcomings in this arena. I've got a friend called Selena who helps me run my Instagram, and she's gay, and she's always course correcting me or just helping me make sure that I don't sound like a total knucklehead when I'm talking, because it's such an evolving topic. You know, and I'd imagine it's quite hard for even people who are queer to keep up with the gossip, as it were. So,
yeah,
I got no chance.
And I realized also that I saying that some people who are gay use the word queer, that's not really my place to tell them what word they should use. And so I appreciate your course correction. It was not an intentional course correction, but you inspired me to say, oh, yeah, I could use different language there.
Yeah, maybe we can all just be humans again. But then maybe even that, maybe there's a sort of non-binary species thing going on that I'm just not aware of yet, probably somewhere.
Plus, I'm an older man, too. I'm 61.
Right.
White. So I came of age at a certain time too.
Mm, yeah. Do you look back on it fondly, or do you just look back on it?
I just look back and I say, thank God I'm not there anymore.
We had this thing. So when I was at school, we had upper, middle and lower schools. And my upper school, which is a school that my dad taught at, they've started doing this alumni group on Facebook where lots of people, got like 1,500 people on there now, whatever. And all these people posting their stories about how much they enjoyed on there. And I joined it for a while, but I just kept thinking, I really have a good thing to say. Like, my dad was a teacher there. I saw him every day. But I still, and I made some friends that I've still got. But I was like, the only thing I could honestly comment was about how I used to get busted for smoking every day. Like, I couldn't think of something where I'd be like, oh, the place was so marvellous or whatever, you know? And it was weird. And I've come out of the group because actually I just kept feeling bad. Before I joined or was aware of that group, I was like, yeah, school was fine. But then everyone else is like, oh, I made such great mates and I had such a, oh, do you remember this class and all that? And I was like, well, I sort of remember it, but... You know, just look back, don't you
go? That's interesting because I have the opposite experience where I had a really hardened remembrance of my time at school. But then once I joined the social media groups, I realized that part of my problem was my own, what I brought to it, my own personality, my own experiences, my own trauma. And I viewed it kind of, we all were just kind of trying to survive adolescence. And so it's, so I'm actually grateful that I guess I had the opposite experience of you. So I, what am I trying to say? I think that's enough.
Yeah. Do you, like, so when you were growing up, because these days I would imagine if you're gay or if you're queer and you're at school, the likelihood is you're going to meet other people in your year a lot more easily or be able to make those connections a lot more easily. Was it more difficult for you? Were you aware of other gay people in your year at school? Anything like that?
No, it wasn't until later that I learned all these other people were gay. And in fact, one said, well, we could have been having fun all that time. So yeah, a couple of people from my class, after the fact, it was a very kind of hyper masculine kind of area too. So, and I think also the era too. So answer your question. No, I mean, I suspected one or two, but.
Yeah, but yeah. It's true. Cause there was somebody else I was talking to and we were just talking about Americana and we were talking about things like the Dukes of Hazzard and all that kind of vibe, which very much was the America that was projected over this side of the pond. And it was like men were men and women were women. That was the job done or whatever. And yeah. I guess if that's a prevailing narrative, it's quite hard for you to go, excuse me. I don't even know who were the big gay icons when you were growing up?
See, that's the thing, is it was people like Charles Nelson Reilly. Who's that other person? But they were the stereotypical kind of campy queens. Mm. And it was kind of viewed as something tragic to be gay at the time.
Yeah, same over here, isn't it? Yeah, and then it takes a long time. Yeah.
And then I think George came around, so things started to open up, and then AIDS came around. So
Yeah. And then, yeah. And that's it. So was Boy George quite a big deal?
Yeah, he was a big deal here. Yeah. I think, the whole British invasion in the 80s thing, just people with big hair kind of coming in. I think it opened up the world just anew. That being said, Kamala Harris, she was a presidential candidate this past year. She said, her mom said, oh, you think you just dropped off out of a coconut tree? And I love that expression, meaning that her mom was saying that you have no perspective of the historical context. So I say the British invasion, all these people with big hair coming over, but who knows, perhaps there were people probably from the punk era before and people before them who were setting the stage for this.
Yeah.
So what I'm trying to say is there's this whole historical context I have no idea about.
Yeah. I'm very grateful in a way that England is a condensed island, but also that we kind of had that musical history, if you like, from, you know, the Beatles. And because actually, yeah, thinking about it, you kind of had Beatles, but around punk, you also kind of had like glam rock and all those kind of things, whichever there was an excuse to like back comb your hair and get some eyeliner on. It was that kind of era, wasn't it? So,
yeah.
That gives a good segue into... my other question is, do you have a favorite band? Do you have a favorite album? What's your music?
Oh, many. I love music. I was raised playing piano and French horn, so I love and singing. So I love music, and I knew you were going to be asking these several questions about favorite things, and so it made me think. And there's some albums where you kind of go through a phase, like where you listen to this album all the time, and then so I listened to some of these albums later. I'm like, well, it doesn't quite hit the same way as it did at the time, but some albums do. One is the first two albums of the B-52s.
Okay.
Their eponymous album and their second one, The Wild Planet, just this kind of punky new wave. And this is another example of, I thought, wow, what a new innovative sound. And I just read recently where I guess John Lennon of the Beatles went home. I guess he saw them or heard them in some bar in New York, went home to Yoko Ono, his wife, who was an avant-garde performance artist, for those people who aren't familiar with her, and said, oh, people are ready for our music now.
Mm.
And so it's another example of, I don't really know the history before what set the stage for the B-52s to come to prominence. Another group that I love is Yaz, or Yazoo in the UK. I love their...
Alison Moyet, right?
Yeah, exactly. And what a beautiful voice she has, yeah. Another album that still hits me is Sade's Lover's Rock. I think that's about the year 2000 or so.
Mm.
And in it, she has a song called Immigrant, where it's talking, the lyrics are something like, didn't know what it was to be black until they gave us change and didn't want to touch his hand. And so I think a lot of my work deals with kind of alienation, kind of feeling kind of disconnected. And so that's, I think there's kind of a theme with some of my music that I like, because I like that. And I also love the music of Mahmood. Are you familiar with Mahmood? He was in Eurovision in 2019 with that song Soldi. He's an Italian singer. And his most recent album, Nei Letti degli Altri, which means like in the bed of others, he talks about, he's of half Sardinian, half Egyptian ancestry. So in his most recent song, Tutta Gold, he talks about, you tell me to go back to my own country. So it's kind of this talk, and some of his song, in the song Soldi, he has a line in Arabic. So kind of this song, this idea of another idea of alienation, being told to go back to your own country. Yeah.
Sade's a good one. Sorry to interrupt. Sade's a good one because when she came out, which was sort of like, late 80s, early 90s with a lot of her songs, they were good songs at the time. I don't think anybody necessarily tuned into the slight significance of it. Because in some ways she was, I don't know, almost a bit like the equivalent of like an Aretha Franklin or something. Like she was singing these beautiful, soulful songs that were making it quite high in the charts over here. And I think now it's almost like she's having a bit of a renaissance because I think she's still performed, you know, she's still around. It's still a thing. And it's just like, she's an interesting one. I like it when you realize that there are people like that. The same with Alison Moyet as well, you know, for me. So I was born in 75. So a lot of that music is the kind of era. I had Cosmic Thing. That was my B-52s album.
I love that one too, yeah.
Yeah. But it's the ones you took for granted, and then it's quite nice to then look back and just be like, God, those guys were really like, they're like the British soul scene of like the 1980s and the sort of jazz funk thing that was going on as well. Those kind of bits that just happened. But you look back and you're just like, yeah, remember that?
That's true, like, because I love funk. Parliament and... Earth, Wind and Fire? And so it's...
I've told this story before, right? When I was growing up, God bless my mum, about the time I was six, when I had to make some big car-based decisions one day, at the end of my bed, I had a poster of a rabbit, and above that, I had a poster of Earth, Wind and Fire. And I think that pretty much set me on the right trajectory, because their costumes were amazing, weren't they? There was... Yeah. I don't know why, and it, who was the other one? Like Brass Construction. There were these bands that just had epic costumes.
Yeah.
We don't seem to get those these days.
Lady Gaga had some for a while. David Bowie, I guess. But they're...
Earth, Wind & Fire, all the time. I've still got some of them on vinyl now. I play a lot of funk to my children, and they like a lot of, like... Well, my wife was into, like, Green Day and the Arctic Monkeys, and I think her DNA seems to be stronger. They're little rockers. Whereas I'm like, no, you want the P-funk. That's... If someone says, make what funk do you want? You go, make my funk the P-funk. That's the end of the story, you know? Happy with that. Books. Do you have a favorite book? What was the last good book you read?
I love the book In Altre Parole. It's an Italian book. It's dual language Italian and English, and in English it means in other words. It's by Giunta Lahiri. Are you familiar with her?
I am not.
She's an American author who I think when she's at university, she went for a week or something to Italy, and then she later, I think she got her PhD in, I think architecture or something. She did it in Italy. Then later, she became a writer, and then she decided just to go live in Italy for a year or so. So she talks about her experience living in Italy and just what it's like to be a foreigner living in another country.
Mm.
And so it was really, I guess it ties in with those themes of alienation, kind of not fitting in. It's really.
Have you ever been to Italy?
Yeah, I have a few times, yeah.
So nice. It's so nice. Yeah. I was thinking if I was going to get a second home, I'd have one. We went to Florence and I've been to Sicily. I like Sicily, man.
I haven't been down there, so you like that?
Mm, it was good. But again, what we tend to do is if we go to a place like that, we try and find a sort of food tour somewhere where you're going to go and visit a market and maybe make a thing. We made some cannoli in Sicily and it was just like, oh, my day.
Oh, that sounds wonderful.
That was so very good. That's cool. What was the name of that author again? Sorry.
Oh, Giumpa Lahiri. It's J-H-U-M-P-A. And the last name's Lahiri, L-A-H-I-R-I.
Very good.
And she is I believe she's a Pulitzer Prize author. She's an award-winning author. Some of her other books are about the South Asian experience in the U.S.
Okay.
So,
that's
yeah.
cool.
So,
yeah. I always write these down because I'm like future presents for my wife for her birthday. She likes a good book. a favorite film?
Yeah. And the Italian theme. I love the films by Guadagnino. He did Io Sono Amore, I Am Love. It has Tilda Swinton in it. Are you familiar with that? I think it's from about 2009 or so. She's the wife of an industrialist or something, just unsatisfied. He's the one who did also Call Me By Your Name.
Okay.
That movie.
Yeah.
Which I love the movie better than the book. The book's good, but there's still, for me, the book has some problematic things in it. Why do I say it's problematic? Because if I recall correctly about the book, I think he says that it's about this queer man coming of age. It's a queer coming of age story. But he talks about something like, oh, I'm like a, or I become the woman or something. I found it problematic, the language kind of like equating this person kind of like becoming the woman or I can't remember, or I want to be the woman. I can't remember because I found that language to be problematic.
Mm.
It's possible because that person's not gay. Or queer, the person who wrote the book, I believe. But the director of the film is gay or queer.
That film smoulders. I remember seeing that film.
Yeah.
Like, smoulders a lot, doesn't it?
And he more recently did Challengers and Queer with Daniel Craig.
Right, okay. Yeah. Have you seen those?
I saw Queer. Wait, have I seen Queer? Because I can't remember. I saw Challengers, but I can't remember if I've seen Queer or not. Because have you seen them?
No.
I can't remember if I've seen Queer or not. I've read about it, but I can't remember if I've seen it.
I'm kind of intrigued. Like, I would like to watch it because I'm intrigued about Daniel Craig's trajectory because he's done Bond. Bond is done. And so it's just been interesting to see the directions and just the kind of fun he seems to be having with his acting career now or something. So.
Yeah, which is because he's set. He can do whatever he wants, which is great.
Pretty much, can't he? Yeah. Did you ever watch Knives Out and Glass Onion? Have you seen those?
I did, yeah. They didn't strike me that much. How about you?
I didn't mind him. Glass Onion, I thought, was good because, spoilers, but it's got that bit where it sort of shifts and then the story kind of retells itself like a layer of an onion. And the thing that made me laugh the most was the fact that my wife, we were watching at home and she fell asleep around the midway point, so therefore missed the entire best part of the story whatsoever. I was just like, oh, it's a bit average. Really. That was good. Is there an interesting fact that not many people know about Brennerhorn?
Let me see.
I mean, there's probably like millions. You just said you're into the French horn, for Christ's sake.
Back in the late 90s, I was a witness for the FBI in a federal blackmail trial. The FBI, for your listeners, is it the National Crime Agency, the equivalent in the UK?
Yeah, I mean, people know what the FBI is. Yeah. So hang on. So you were a witness
for the FBI in a what? In a blackmail trial.
Are you allowed to talk about it?
I believe so, yeah, because that was back in the late 90s. Yeah, I worked for this guy who, I guess in his side life, he also was, I think, director or had some big wig position at the French International School in San Francisco. And so I was this guy's secretary. So I basically screened all of his mail and his faxes and the like. So he was faxed a note saying that, I guess they had to let some teacher go at that school. So they faxed a note to my boss at his other job where I worked, saying that, oh, you basically, you have to put such and such amount of money into such and such account by such and such date or you will suffer the consequences. And so I said, oh, wow. So I went to my boss and I said, oh, you have to read this. And he said, oh, yeah, I'll read it. I said, no, you have to read it right now. And he said, wow. So then we contacted campus police and then they contacted the FBI. And then there was a big trial. I'd never really been in a courtroom before. So I just pictured it as a big, kind of like in Dynasty, you know, that show with Joan Collins. Mm-hmm. We call it Dynasty, but you call it Dynasty, right?
Yeah.
I just pictured this big dramatic scene. And so that's kind of informed how I acted in the courtroom as a witness. So,
did you have big shoulders on at the time as well? Did you really lean into the fashion?
But the guy I worked for, he was a PhD, had a PhD, and the attorney kept calling him Mr. B. I won't say his name. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, it's Dr. B. So I kept correcting the attorney. So.
That's cool. God, that was quite dramatic. Did they do it in like, was it just written normally or did they do the old cutting all the letters together kind of like?
It was just written, I think it was, I can't remember if it was handwritten or, it wasn't the crazy letters like you're talking about, the kind of letters. But the weird thing is they faxed it from one of those stores like Kinko's or FedEx. And so there were security cameras showing them going to the store at that time and faxing it. So they had the evidence that it was, that they were the people. So
schoolboy error, sure.
Exactly.
Yeah, nice one. That's good. That must have been very good. I can't imagine. Did you look at it and were like, And then go, huh? Like, or did you, like, I don't know, you can almost think that wasn't real or something, right? Like, it's such a bizarre thing to come through as a fax or whatever. It must have felt a bit unreal at the time again.
Yeah, I was kind of frightened when I got it. Well, because this is the US, guns, blah, blah, blah.
So, yeah, unfortunately. That's cool. The only other question, normally we just cut to the chase now, we just finish it. I just wanted to know what you've got coming down the pipeline, because you're working on Sampler. Have you finished number 19? Are you still working on it?
Still working on it. Well, I have this thing called Trigger Thumb. Have you ever heard of that?
Is it like Trigger Finger, but different?
It was Trigger Finger. It's like where it clicks. With Trigger Thumb, it's probably the same thing, I guess, I imagine, where this joint just kind of clicks. And it, I got a shot at last month or so, and it's doing much better. So what I'm trying to say is I haven't stitched in a while, so I intend to get back to it because it seems to be doing much better. But to what I have coming down the pike is, I don't know, I've applied for a show, for a fellowship. We'll see what happens. Sometimes it's kind of a crapshoot if you get in or not. And so, yeah.
Well, I'll say this much to you. Like, I'm trying to make moves in my town to get an art gallery up and running. We've opened an art space, and that's been really well received. And we've got funding from the Arts Council to open an art gallery if we can make it work. And I always wanted it to be a three-stage or three-phase gallery. So we'd have a space for schools and colleges to like display their work, because there isn't one. Then something that supports local artists. And then because I'm me, I want to do like world-class embroidery and needlework gallery. And you are on my long list, my darling.
Oh, wow.
Definitely, somewhere down the line. I mean, obviously, it's a bit like it's just a pipe dream at the moment. But I am quite determined, because I think that there just isn't a gallery that's kind of dedicated to that. It's always like every now and again there's a needlework show or something, you know, whereas I just want to be able to, I'm pretty sure I could program like 5 years worth of content off the top of my head. So yeah, That's what I'm going to do. And I just think your stuff's so amazing, and I've been such a fan of it the whole time.
Oh, thanks.
That'd be really kind of lovely to have it in the mix somewhere down the line. So.
And I love to show in spaces like that, nonprofit spaces and universities, because there's no pressure to sell, and you can actually have meaningful dialogues with people come through, which I like.
Yeah, I do wonder that sometimes, isn't it, whether the need to sell very much excludes some work from ever being presented because people wouldn't think to buy it. Sort of. Needlework falls into that funny space, doesn't it, where the amount you want to charge for it never really matches up in people's heads to the amount they think they should pay for it, right? Hey, Bren, thanks for having a needle exchange with me.
And I'm so grateful to you for chatting with me today, and also just for all your promotion of my career, and just for the friendship.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for joining me on another Needle Exchange. I hope you enjoyed the show. I'd love to hear from you, so feel free to email hello@needle.exchange, that's NWDL.exchange, with any thoughts, comments or feedback. And if you want to keep up with all the news, sign up to the Needle Exchange mailing list at bit.ly/needleexchange. See you next time.